No, the whole extraterrestrial thing is not a viable solution to this.
We need to go through a turning point in the study of this whole domain, away from ideology. We're not here to prove that we're being visited by, you know, aliens from this planet or that star. That may very well be true, but we have not done the basic work.
I have this hunch that this phenomenon is comes from some sort of domain of pure information. And the fact that they can interact with us at all suggests that that we inhabit a domain that's also pure information.
Are we go conditioned here? Yes.
My friend, we are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence, based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Mysterioso?
So, we're doing this as a pre-record, which is fine, because I think I'm going to have to start doing that more because of the weekend coast-to-coast stuff. Tonight, whenever you're listening, I'm talking to Cassidy Nicholas, who's the associate communications producer for MUFON. Is that right?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, national, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
She's also written three books on the paranormal and is a field investigator also for MUFON. And you've done a bit of interviewing radio stuff, right?
I did for a couple of years. Yes, I did.
How did that go?
I loved it. It was... For me, I take it very seriously. So if I was interviewing a guest and they had a book, I would force myself to completely ingest that book that week. And I think that that was the most trying part of it, was because I wasn't going to interview somebody and say, so you wrote this book. That's great. Tell me about it. I wanted to discuss with them. I wanted to give them, you know, what, you know, my thoughts and ask them about different things and theories that they discussed. So for me, doing radio was a lot of fun. I learned a lot in a couple of years because I was just book after book after book, you know. So I loved it. I learned so many different avenues from, you know, different paranormal, supernatural stuff to ufology. It was all over the board. So I loved it.
Yeah. What did any of your interviews really affect you? Because I find that happens with certain people I talk to. It's like, okay, this changed my complete outlook. Dean Radin did that to me.
Yes, Laird Scranton did that to me. Laird Scranton's a cosmologist that has talked about the Dogon, who he wrote the Velikoskoffe Heresies. Mm-hmm. And his books were so good that even though I was interviewing him on one, I found myself just buying them up. Like it was such easy read. It was so interesting, and his work is so detailed. And, you know, later I befriended him and his wife, which was amazing, and their son. And, you know, now we have an open friendship with each other. But before that, listening to him talk about different things, it was so off the board that, you know, it's not something that a normal person would pick up and say, oh, this looks interesting. Laird Scranton was a big one. Some of the darker, like the paranormal cases that were really detailed, some of the people that I interviewed, those were just so sad to me to hear them. So they were another one that kind of changed a lot, but a lot of my you know, research that I would normally do on a daily spectrum started to expand because of these guests. You know, some of them I'm like, eh, you know, but there was a few like Laird, you know, it just opens you up to a whole new avenue that is insanely interesting.
I think you do the interviewing for the same reason I do, which is you get to talk to people who you read their book and it's like, well, I'd like to ask them about this. And then uh-huh. if you get lucky, you get to the point where you can just call them up and, you know, and they really, you know, then the relationship really takes off and you get to bounce ideas off them and learn from them. And I've had quite a few people on my show and earlier in the magazine that did that. And it's like putting yourself through another college, I think.
Oh, absolutely. And the thing is if you take the time to, you know, absorb that person before you interview them, the interviews are so much more interesting for your audience. They have so much more to them. So instead of saying, oh, this is interesting, you wrote a book about UFOs, tell me about it and we'll discuss it. No, you say, you know, I really like this part. Could you expand on this? That's what I found really rewarding.
How many times have you been interviewed?
Depending on what. I did a lot of paranormal work for about 10 years. And in that, it kind of grew to a lot of different interviews, a lot of different things like that. But when I kind of switched gears a few years ago, I became very quiet for a time and didn't do any interviews at all. And this is probably in the last, I'd say, 3 years, this is my third interview that I've done. And I got a little quiet for a while and had to reevaluate some things. So recently, three. In the past few years, I've done many.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because the thing I was going to ask you is the first thing everybody asks, how'd you get involved? So how did you? I mean, what's the source of your interest? Everybody has a different story, it seems like.
Well, like I previously just said, I was in the paranormal. I did a lot of like historian occult research. I did a lot of historian research, Native American footpaths, you know, trying to trace and put together history with current supernatural happenings and seeing if I can chase urban legends to see, you know, what the origin was of them, which is a lot of fun. It's very trying. It's a lot of dusty archives. It's a lot of, you know, dirty paperwork, but
yeah.
I had a lot of fun with it. And it got to the point where I wasn't finding the deep needed research that from individuals around me. I wasn't finding people that really were researching things. They were like half-hatting it, you know, they were like, and you know, oh, I'm an expert on this subject. And I'll say, well, what about the deed? Did you read this in 1847 where this changed and this turned? And they'll be like, what are you talking about? So I got to the point where I got frustrated and I wanted more. I wanted more individuals that were educated and that wanted to learn and, you know, expand. And I found that in ufology, because the caliber of people that study this seem to, you know, really be interested in the subject and really always pulling files, always just continuing their search. So when I found that, I decided, you know, maybe I'll try and move on again. I was in it a few years before, didn't really do much, got into it this time, and it would just exploded. It was just one after thing after another, and it was just on from there. So I wanted more out of people, I guess, in the field, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, I don't know if you've listened to my shows, but my big bugaboo with UFO research, and we can go back and forth with this, is that I think they're looking for one specific thing, and that's basically what's holding everything back. Do you want me to expand on that?
Yes, absolutely.
I think the majority of UFO people in the UFO field, and especially in MUFON, are looking for evidence of extraterrestrial visitation, which, mm-hmm. from my perspective, is... You're quickly learning on my show that I go back and forth with the guests. I don't just ask questions.
Uh-huh.
But from my perspective, the ETH is kind of holds everything back and keeps you from looking at other things, even that might give you insight into the ETH. And that by presupposing the answer to the question, if you know what I mean, uh-huh. you are limiting what you would look at, how would you would interpret, and what, you know, different avenues of research and answers. And that's my main beef with large UFO groups. I wanted to know what you think of that, if you agree, and we can go on with it.
Well, when it comes to any kind of civilian-based organization, you have an obnoxious amount of different kinds of people, different backgrounds, different religions, different beliefs, different life, you know, experiences. So I think that every single person is their own separate entity and their own separate unit, and they're going to look at research differently, and they're going to want to do things differently or predispose things differently. And I think that one of the problems with that is that nobody, you know, wants to work together. And what we're trying to do as an organization is say, everybody's allowed to be different. Everybody's allowed to, you know, believe what they want. But in the same time, what MUFON is trying to do is really evaluate, you know, the FI forms and the different questions and the different ways to look at things to try to avoid some of that. Because depending on the case, you know, you can't, when I walk into something, I am a completely blank slate. You know, I interview the person, I watch the person, and I really try to get a feel for, you know, how they're feeling. And this could be anything, but you can't really predispose things, which is, you know, what you said, your problem is everybody, you know, wants to find just a certain thing when there is so many different avenues. And you kind of have to sit back after you've collected your data and say, okay, what am I looking at? And not just say, okay, they saw this thing in the sky, it moved up and down, it's a UFO, or it was orange, so automatically it's a Chinese lantern. You know, you kind of have to sit back with that data and stop hurrying and just start really researching everything about it. So I can agree with you in an aspect, but I think that as the future progresses, hopefully that will stop and a more open-mindedness will come with, I'm not saying like cosmic guru open mind. I'm talking like a full spectrum of, instead of, you know, looking at something and immediately saying, this is what it is. We don't know what it is.
Or what it isn't, for that matter.
Yeah. And stop just automatically saying, well, I've done this for so long, I can tell you. No, you have to, everything is different. Every case is different. It involves different people, different areas, everything about it. So people need to sit with that collection and just, instead of hurrying, just look at it and say, okay, how can I expand this? I don't know what this is. You know, it might not be extraterrestrial. It may be, you know, something else. So hopefully they'll stop. Everybody will start to take more time and dig a little bit more.
Yeah, but you see, in your answer, part of that you said, I don't know if it's extraterrestrial. And I see that's already a presupposition.
That's true. You're right. So, well, when I look at something, if somebody puts a UFO case into, you know, my database, and I know I'm in charge of, you know, trying to figure out what it is, mm-hmm. you know, you look at first, you know, if you can dismiss it, you know, how can you dismiss it? And you go about different ways, you know, different right. tools that are used and things. So the first thing I do is I try to do everything in my power to say, okay, this is actually what this is. And even though it was scary for that person, it's because they don't understand that they're seeing a Chinese lantern. They don't understand that it could be a 3R3Bs. They don't understand this because it's not something in their daily life. Mm-hmm. So, you know, picking that apart first is, you know, not going, oh, they saw a ball in the sky. It's automatically a UFO. Let's go. You know?
Yeah.
And, you know, so I'm kind of picky. I'm kind of the IFO nut. I really pick apart everything. So yes, I guess you would say, because I said, is it extraterrestrial or not? Could be a lot of different things, and you're right.
So how does that work across a big organization like MUFON? Is it on the public face to my, as far as I can tell, what with the TV shows and Hangar, whatever it was called, Hangar 18? Uh-huh.
Hangar 1.
What MUFON seems to be very invested in the extraterrestrial explanation. And if it's not, how do you communicate that to the members, like field investigators especially? It's like, you're going to gather data, we are going to ask completely, you know, non-specific questions. Is that the way it's done right now? Or, and the other part of that is, a lot of the members, you can't really get that idea out of their mind to just kind of be a non not ask leading questions and basically be an observer and all that. Is that part of the policy of MUFON now?
It absolutely is. And, you know, in the field investigators manuals and a lot of like our state directors are phenomenal. Some of them hold seminars every month, you know, and they talk to, you know, the organization and they talk to the people in their state and say, you know, you cannot ask leading questions. You have to try to gain from the witness basically a raw footage of what happened. And you can't say, well, do you think it was this? Or did it make a whirling sound or anything? You just say, okay, so what else can you tell me? Instead of saying, what noise did it make? Because if it made a noise, they're going to say it.
Yeah.
Or, you know, like, did it sound like this? No. You're going to say, just walk me back through it. And then gather your information from there. Because a lot of times, if somebody's scared or they don't understand, they're going to say, oh, well, it kind of did make a whirling noise now that I think about it. And you don't want that. You want to say, walk me through what happened. And and RFI manuals are very strict on that. They keep, you know, saying, do not ask leading questions. So it is, you know, it is put in the training for these individuals that do field investigative work to not do that. And everybody, like I said, everybody's a different person. You're going to have some that are very chatty. You're going to have some that are not. You're going to have some that go to the scene of every single one, even if it was a July 4th orange light. They're still going to go out there. Yeah. You know what I mean, though?
Yeah.
Like, we have very dedicated FIs. They all handle it differently. And some are very short-winded. Some are very long. So it just depends. But it is in our training manuals to not ask leading questions and to gain that material. You know, once you get further in the interview, they have given you the actual event, how it happened, then you can go through and start, you know, talking to them and expanding on different things they said. That's at least how I do things. That's how they train us to do things. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're not like, we don't show up and say, okay, did you see an alien? No. No,
well, I didn't think you did that. So I was a field investigator a zillion years ago. I don't think I went out on any investigations at all because nothing happened while I was doing it. This was like in the early 90s, I think, or the late 80s, you know, when I was young and even stupider than now. But, you know, what kind of data is gathered? And you know, on top of that, what's done with that data? And we'll get into that a little bit. Do you think it's adequate and what's done with it?
Well, it depends on the case. Depends on, you know, what category, what's going on. And depending on the field investigator, we have an array of, like I said, a spectrum. I like that word, a spectrum of investigators. And a lot of times, if there is any kind of, you know, something that's ruled as, you know, a close encounter of some kind, or if there is any trace evidence, it is collected, it is sent. And, it, you know, or, you know, we have Mark D'Antonio. He analyzes a lot of video and audio or video and pictures and things like that. And then there's steps this takes, because if we have a case that's amazing and the FI did a great job, then what it does is gets pulled into kind of like a basket, and the scientific review board starts to review it again, and they may possibly reopen it. And then it'll go, you know, do we have a different team now that goes through and tries to get, if the complete case is done, then we want to get it on film. We want to talk to these people and document it properly. And everything is in the CMS. Everything is there, and different cases are expanded in different ways after they're closed even.
But what kind of data is taken and what's done with that data? Does it go into a big database?
Absolutely. I mean, you can find, even being in the public, you can find every case that's been put into our CMS data system today. And then we have to the Pandora files too, which are the more paper cases that were predating CMS. But when we go out there, you get everything from, you know, general estimation of height and size. And, you know, then after that, you talk to the witness, and then after that, if there is trace evidence, then it's collected. Most of the time, there really isn't. Take a lot of measurements, things like that. And then after you go home, you know, you're going to research, after discussing it with the witness, you're going to research everything that you have down to, and you're going to expand your search to local airports, military bases, MOAs. You're going to, you know, a lot. Some of the field investigators that have the equipment will, you know, look for radiation or, you know, EMF and everything gets evaluated. It's all these steps. And then you can go to different, you know, organizations. Did they get anything that night as well? So there's a lot of different stuff that gets done after the fact. And a lot of FIs will actually go back out again and discuss with people. So there's a lot of stuff. And then after that report is finished, if it's a very good case, like usually it will be opened up by, if the state director is okay with it and whatever, by a different team and even expanded further and further and further. We have a military sub team that if it's a military oriented one, even if it's closed as an unknown, they will start to pick it up and say, okay, let's reopen this. Let's keep going. So when it depends on the case. A lot of them are, I saw a light in the sky, or I saw an orange light, or I saw this light and it had a white light and it had a green light on one side and a red light on the other. And it was completely silent. You know, so there's a lot of cases that are mixed in there for, like, as a case investigator, a lot of them will go for 4 or 5 years and get everything that's, you know, it's so-so. Then they'll get one good case. So it's not like these come in all the time. These are you know, one in 100, 200, 300 cases that are worth that third and fourth look and that, analyzing. So...
Right. Are there any conclusions made about them, in fact, except for the fact that something is unidentified? Because when most people say, well, it was never identified, so therefore it must be some extraterrestrial craft. Does MUFON encourage that, or is that part of the culture, or do they just say, look, this is unidentified, and and that goes in the unidentified file?
That's exactly right. That is exactly right. Like, if we don't know, we're not going to say that was a spaceship, because we don't know, because we are just people. You know, they're going to go in the unknown, you know, the unknown bin. And from there, you know, there are so many people in the organization, they go through and sometimes, you know, later on, you can open up an unknown and say, oh my gosh, that's, you know, a small drone. That's, right. You know, but of course, when they first started coming out, people weren't really familiar with them.
Right.
So, you know, you can open up a case that was an unknown from 5 years ago and say, that's a drone.
Yeah.
And then it goes for further investigation and, you know, it gets changed. So it's not always extraterrestrial. It's always, we don't know what it is.
Yeah. Yeah, and you've been using acronyms like FI, which I guess means field investigator, and CMS, which I think means case management system.
I'm sorry, Greg. Yes, yes.
Okay.
Field investigator. Sorry. Yes. Case management system is at, if you go to MUFON.com, they actually have a button there that says, you know, research or track UFOs or whatever. And you can click on it, and you can literally type in a state or a time frame, and it will upload, I believe, up to 50. And what it will show is the witness statement, but it will not give any information on, you know, who, what, when, where, why. But it will show you, you know, there was a sighting in this town at this date. And a lot of people will go to that, use that tool, use the search options, and then, you know, call MUFON or put in a thing in that says, hey, I found this on your site, or I found this here. I saw this too. So it's kind of interesting.
How open is that data? Because did not Robert Bigelow buy up all the data last year or the year before, or pay a bunch of money to MUFON to own the data, or does he just have access to it?
Well, I've been back in MUFON for 3 years, Greg.
Yeah.
And I will tell you, Bigelow has nothing to do with MUFON. Whatever happened a long time ago, I can tell you that all the data is in our base, all of it, because I'm also the archivist for MUFON as well.
Uh-huh.
And it's my job to go through all these old cases stemming back all the way from 2006. And they're all still there. They're all complete. And he has nothing to do with MUFON. In my time frame, it was before my time. And so all of our data is our own. And
okay.
As for the last 3 years that I have been extremely involved in the organization, that name is not used. That name is not involved at all.
How free is this data? Can anybody use it completely free to do, you know, database searches, to do comparisons, to do meta-analysis, all this? Or is it proprietary to MUFON in some way?
What we do is the witness is extremely protected. Their information, and even if they say, like, in their witness statement, they'll say, I was going down Apple Street,
yeah,
and I turned on Pear Street, and that's when I saw it. Apple and Pear will be removed.
Right.
Or my sister, Jenny. My sister bolt will be removed. Like, they will go through and remove any kind of information.
Yeah, totally understandable, because you don't want people's privacy invaded, so that's fine.
Absolutely. And now, even on top of that, so you, Greg, could go into MUFON and search cases. It's going to tell you what category it is, and I believe the county...
Uh-oh, you cut off.
That was so strange. My internet completely dropped for, like, 30 seconds. I have no idea what happened.
Oh, that's okay. See, we just start talking about really important stuff, and then...
They're watching.
I've written whole articles about being paranoid and how things look when you're paranoid, and, you know, after a while, you know, I talked to somebody who used to investigate the Kennedy assassination, Paul Krasner.
Yeah.
We were talking about being paranoid because he went through a horrible period of it. And I said, well, what brought you out of it? He goes, it gets old. I got tired of it.
I always said, I go, you know what? Like, I would get dropped phone calls when I was talking to certain people. We'd get on certain subjects. My phone would disconnect. It would just completely drop. And I'm like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
Here we go. So finally, you know, after coming to the realization with either I'm being paranoid or I am of interest of some reason,
yeah,
I finally got to the point within myself that said, well, if I'm of some interest and I'm worth somebody's paycheck, then, you know, if they feel the need to monitor me, they can. I'm not hurting anything. I'm not, you know, doing anything. And if they feel the need that I need to be monitored, let them. I'm paying somebody's dinner bill, you know?
Yeah. And the thing is, it's like, you know, it's a thing that Bill Moore said to me. It's like, you play the game or you get nothing. So on a completely different level, it's kind of like, okay, you're going to give up because you're scared. You think somebody's listening to you?
Yeah.
Or just assume somebody's listening to you. It's like, look, I'm not involved in drugs, child porn, anything like that. So they can't get me on that. So I'm just going to go ahead with the thing that I'm doing because I need to learn and I have to talk to people.
Yeah. And, you know, minus the dropped phone calls or the internet drops or things like that that are random, they seem to be, you know, and I did get kind of nervous about it. Why I said, what am I doing that's upsetting somebody? You know, I'm just researching things that are out there. I'm not trying to hurt anybody. You know, but then I finally got to the point where I thought, well, okay, then listen, hopefully you can learn some things, you know?
Yeah.
Or, if you know, have any input, just say it.
Yeah. Or, you know, just make the assumption that nobody is listening and it's just something that you think is happening, especially with the way that internet drops calls all the time. I go from, you know, completely reliable Skype connection to, it's shutting off every 5 minutes, you know, you never know. On top of that, like I said, it's like, you know, what are you going to do? Either be scared and quit or just ignore it and accept it as part of your life. I used to get letters from Carla Turner. Every single one of them were opened.
Yeah.
And there was a cattle mutilation researcher in New Jersey. Almost all the letters I got from him were either opened or like ripped apart. And then there were a little thing saying post office says, you know, sorry, this letter was mangled or whatever in our system. Mm-hmm. It's like, if somebody wanted to open the letter and look at it without me knowing, they could do that.
Oh yeah.
But so apparently somebody wanted me to know, as far as I can tell, that my mail was sort of being watched, because I get mail from all kinds of people, but only Carla Turner and this other guy would have the mail messed with.
Yeah, and you know what? It's the aspect of, if somebody feels that I'm doing something, then let them. I mean,
yeah,
really. I mean, people always are like, privacy, privacy, privacy. We have no privacy.
No, not really. You have to live in a cave if you want any privacy.
Yeah, you can't have electric. You can't have, you know, you're not going to have privacy. They know everything about you, and it's their job to do that. And it's like, well, okay, I like the internet. I use it. I use a lot of research. And I need those tools to further myself. And if I need to be, you know, monitored because of it, it's okay. Like, if they feel the need, I'm okay with that.
Yeah. I'm still interested in privacy issues and, you know, open source and all that. I support that as much as I can. But the thing is that you can't. Yeah. Like you said, I mean, right now I've got a piece of note. What's it called? Post-it over the camera on my computer.
So do I,
yeah,
all the time.
Just because, you know, unless I'm talking to somebody where I need it.
Oh, yeah. I'm kind of crazy about that because I'm, you know, I like privacy in that aspect, absolutely. But if it's somebody that's paid to do it and they're, you know, it's not something malicious, whatever.
Yeah.
Do what you got to do because I'm not hurting anybody.
Right. Okay, so, what we were talking about before the NSA cut us off was
dun, dun, dun.
Yeah, was you know, the extent, the how open is the information at MUFON in their database, mm-hmm. and can that be accessed by anybody to do any kind of research rather than just kind of seeing, I mean, high level research, or is that just basically restricted to MUFON, whatever, whoever has access to the database in the organization?
It really depends on the situation. As of right now, I know that we are rebuilding. One of the things that we are doing within the organization is rebuilding our database. We are updating it. We are making it even more secure than it is. And as for, like, you know, Joe Schmo saying, hey, I want to know about this, he can actually try to find out, you know, what was happening in an area. They're not going to give any details. If you are a researcher who is writing a book or something, we're still not going to give you those witness details unless the witness says okay.
I don't care about the witness. What I care about is what was gathered and what was, you know, how accessible is it? Because I'll tell you my motivation for asking this question.
Okay.
A few years ago, I gave a speech basically saying large UFO groups should be disbanded.
Okay.
I have changed that because they're valuable as a, I think mainly as a data gathering entities. Mm-hmm. But I have this belief, I think, that if enough data is gathered, which it has been, and the way that it's gathered and what kind of questions are asked may be a really important part of understanding what's going on, because then you can start doing, you know, gather millions of data points together and start running very strange, different scenarios on them, or looking for patterns, or forcing patterns on them that nobody is, you know, or asking questions of the data that nobody has before. And that's what interests me the most. And that's the basis of a lot of my questions is, you know, is MUFON using this data, one, to try and do, you know, like a metadata, I can't think anymore. What's wrong with me? I think I'm going to need more caffeine. But they're trying to use this all the data they've collected to tell them, you know, to tell us something about the phenomenon based on things that are hidden in that data. You know Absolutely. What I mean? And it would be nice if, you know, at least some, you know, not anybody, but like a researcher says, look, this is what I want to do with the data. This is the kind of analysis I want to run on it. May mm-hmm. I have access to that data? Is that possible?
Absolutely. You could do it right now.
Okay.
Absolutely. Like,
I want to see what happens on Wednesdays at 2:00 to people with Irish ancestry or something like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. That would be, you know, a lot of different, like, okay, to give you an example, Greg, a few months ago, a different person, approached me and said, I would like to know all of the cases that had a surrounding of absolute silence during the event.
Uh-huh.
And I said, that's a lot of cases.
Yeah.
And, you know, and he said, but, you know, I'm researching something. I found something really strange. Like, I want the dogs, the bugs, the wind, the rustling in the trees, everything quiet. And I said, okay. And I set out, and with our database, we also have keyword searches, which are really, really cool to use. And it kind of starts picking apart different cases from different years, you know, complete silence or everything went quiet, or, you know, it takes some time to do it. Mm-hmm. But I was able to give him the statistics and by state. It took me a couple weeks to do it, but it was worth it in the end, you know, by state, how many cases, you know, throughout year from year, you know, this year, how many cases, you know, did have the absolute silence or did have, you know, things like that. So a lot of times if I get a question like that, I absolutely go to work. It's part of my job as an archivist. You know, I want to know how many people that, you know, have three witnesses or over that were not family members saw the same thing in the year 1987. We might not have anything, you know, but we may have 6 or 7 or 100 cases, you know. And so, statistics-wise, I'm kind of a statistical animal. I love graphs and I love making things and watching numbers. I'm very big in it. And so we have the ability to go through and bring these statistics out. And we're trying to expand on that, to open that to the public and say, you know, this many cases happened here and this was the origins of them, or that we think, or, you know, this was the, you know, credibility of the witness. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So yeah, that is all you can search that out. I think you only get 50 at a time, but you could, like, if you went to the site, Greg, you could go, okay, I'm looking for disc-shaped objects in the years 1985 to 1997 that hovered in this county under 500 feet and were silver in color. Boom. It's going to pull everything up for you and show you, but it's not going to show you the witness information, but it's going to show you the events.
Only 50 at a time?
Yes.
Why is that?
That's just the way the system is right now. I don't know. I can't answer that. But I know that we are doing a new system, so hopefully we'll be... And another cool thing with the new system is it'll be able to start flapping things. You know, things that people might not have seen. Oh, this case over here that was an unknown closed in 2009 by this FI. And then all of a sudden, 3 or 4 years later, we get, you know, 2 more cases put in. It's going to start to realize the dates by itself. It's going to be really neat. So I'm pretty excited about it.
Yeah, because I think examining the data without, you know, one, without a presupposition, and two, it may be a supposition that makes no sense logically.
Yeah.
Because to me, the whole field makes no sense. Not the whole field, but the whole phenomenon makes no sense logically. Applying crazy logic to it might help. I've got strange ideas. I mean, if you listen to any of my shows, you'd know. And
okay.
The stuff that I wrote, I'm about to release, it has a lot of those crazy ideas in it. But
that's kind.
Another one of the crazy ideas I have that I wanted to ask you about is, when the field investigator goes out, what are the standard questions? I mean, besides, what did you see? What direction was it going? What color? All the normal stuff. I get, you know, I guess you ask about the weather and things like that. But do you ask about anything else, like the person's background, their family, their history of any health problems or mental problems, which might be a problem with some people because they'll say, you're calling me crazy.
Yep.
Has nothing to do with, you know, it shouldn't have anything to do with it. But just deeper questions like that. And then other ones like, which, you know, this is making the question even more complicated, but other things like, what were you thinking? How did it make you feel? And then later, which I think is very important, how did it affect you later? What happens in the next day, week, month, year to the person? Does it change their life? Does it do anything to them? Things like that I think are very interesting and might be interesting to have in a database.
Actually, that is one of the most interesting aspects of this whole research field to me, is the aftermath, the psychological effects, and how it affects them. To me, I find that probably the most interesting of all is how that person handles what they saw or what happened. And there are, you know, and we have literally forms for that that the FI is to fill out. We want to ask, you know, what were you doing at the time?
Yeah.
Were you traveling? Were you out for a cookout? And if that, you know, were you drinking? Were you under the influence of drugs? Were you taking any medications? Things like that. That all has to be approached. And a lot of people, you know, look at you like you have 5 foreheads. But I think, you know, if you had 6 or 7 beers and then, you know, claim to communicate with an extraterrestrial, you know, it makes a little bit of a difference. But
yeah.
I'm not saying, you know, so we want to know what they were doing at the time. You know, if alcohol was involved, it's a very important aspect of it. Or, you know, how they view what they saw, how they, you know, view the event. And a lot of times, you know, Greg, what people don't see when they criticize what civilian organizations do is what it actually does to a witness that is, you know, involved in a close encounter of some kind. You know, they don't think about that. And they don't think about years later that they're still up at night at the same time, or they close their shades every night because now they're afraid, or they don't go out at night. This really happens. These people become very paranoid. Not all the time, but I mean, it's a scary thing. It, you know, sometimes people handle it very well. They're very interested in what happened. They think it's pretty neat. You know, other times these people are scared. Nightmares. You know, we have an experiencer research team for people who do have very close encounters of whatever they are, whatever it is, whatever it may be. It could be a squirrel and they didn't realize it. But what I'm saying is we have a very close encounter research team that actually, you know, deals one-on-one with these people. Because some of these cases, Greg, are heartbreaking when they come in. These people are terrified.
Yeah.
I woke up, I'm missing 5 hours. I don't have any of my stuff. I don't know where I've been. And these people are mortified. And a lot of times in these witness statements, they will say, nobody is going to believe me. I need to talk to a therapist. I need to call the police. And some people do call the police. Some people do say whatever's happened. So it's a lot of times with my cases, even I can talk to you on a personal account of this. All the cases that I've ever worked, when I go out and interview those people, they have my home number. They can call me. And I've had people call me 1 month, 2 months later and say, you know, this happened. Do you think this was involved? And they're still scared.
I hate to be mercenary, but do you put that in their, you know, in their file as something that's going on? Because I don't know if this stuff, how quantifiable are these things? I think there's got to be a way to quantify these things. I think feelings, impressions, effects, emotional, all these things are very important to have in the database, I think.
Oh, absolutely. Actually, one of the forms that we use has a whole thing of everything from if they felt ringing in their ears, or, you know, after this event happened, my ears have been ringing for like 3 days. That's all important.
Yeah.
Or my nose I've been experiencing a bloody nose, or I can't sleep. Or these things are all documented, all of them. It's an extremely very, very important part of what field investigators need to do. They need to go that extra route. They need to talk to these people. Like, a lot of people think that they go out and they look at a field and go, okay, I'll write it down. No, this is a long thing. This is not that's how it should be handled. This is not something that's a one thing. You know, I always find myself going out to different locations 2 to 3 times at least, and sitting down, talking with these people. I've had so many chocolate chip cookies, you know, so much lemonade, because these people want to talk about it and they need somebody to talk about it to, because they can't go to their neighbor and be like, hey, Joe, did you see that bouncing, you know, silver light over in the field over there? It's crazy. My wife doesn't want to go outside to walk the dog. They can't say that because there's like that stigma, you know, whatever. So I think it's extremely important. It's actually, like I said, my favorite part of doing this is dealing with the people themselves. Even if they're staring at Venus.
Yeah.
Even if they are absolutely positive.
Yeah. What do they think that your motivation is? Do they ask you? Because my idea is, when an investigator from MUFON shows up, if I have seen something, my idea is that they're looking for evidence of extraterrestrials. Because that's the public persona of a civilian UFO organization. And that, I think that would affect how they, you know, how they recount their story to you.
Well, absolutely. And you can't avoid that. But the only reason an FI would be there is if they put a report in. So if they put a report into us, that gets assigned to a state director. And then a state director or chief field investigator will disperse them to the nearest FI in the area, unless it is a more like a close encounter group. Then we have the STAR team and things like that that will go in, that have done a lot of cases under their belt. They've dealt with a lot of people. And so, I mean, for us to even go out there to be part of it, it's, you know, they had to ask us first.
It's so hard to get away from a preconception. I've got a friend that he said his point, which I think is pretty significant, is that when somebody is recounting to you what they saw,
mm-hmm.
they are not recounting to you what happened at the time. They're recounting to you their memory of it. And as they talk about it, that changes. And as you ask questions, that changes. Is that something that a field investigator would take into account? Or is there anything that can be done about that? Because, the human mind is recording this, and the human mind is horribly inaccurate about a lot of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, we do have hypnosis therapists and things like that, if it's that extreme an event. But usually, you know, in the FI manual, if you ask a question and they answer it, you know, a few minutes later, you're going to ask the same question in a different way, and you're going to want to see how they answer that. You're going to want to see if they're pulling, or they're starting to lose a train of thought, or exaggerating, or fabricating, honestly. And so the FIs are trained to ask things in a different way, several minutes apart, to see, you know, what these people really have in their head.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just trying to, usually most of my questions will follow on, but I've hammered you with a whole bunch of very specific questions.
That's okay. Oh, yeah.
We'll keep on MUFON for a little bit. if you were in MUFON, would you? I mean, if you were in the hierarchy of determining how what direction the organization was taking, would you want to change anything?
I think that, you know, as in any civilian organization, things change constantly because it's so many different people, so many different opinions, so many, you know, and right now, you know, there's things about MUFON that are really, really good. There's things that are so good, but the things that needed to be changed are blossoming. Like the one big thing is MUFON really needs to, you know, get more information out there. They know that. So now we're releasing statistics, we're releasing archives, we're building a digital archive to showcase, you know, some cases that are really legitimate and, you know, in our aspect, you know, highly credible witnesses, you know, civilian pilots, military, police force. And so we're trying to showcase this information to get it out to the public. You know, we're not trying to hoard it. And I think that that's a great step. And we're expanding our journal, which is all different stories, all different cases. So the information expansion is happening, and I'm very excited about that. And I think that we're headed in a good direction, honestly. We really are, because anybody that says, well, you know, what do you do with your data? Well, we are producing it. We are showing the public, hey, this is why this is important. You know, you can say, you know, this, you know, there's nothing strange going on in the world. Here is 10,000, you know, 10,000 different things that say maybe there is. We have, just in our database as of, I think, yesterday, we have about 75,000 cases in there. And then we have about 10,000 in the Pandora files. So, like I said, a lot of them are IFOs. A lot of them have been figured out. A lot of them could be, you know, Joe Schmo flying a little plane and that the FI at the time couldn't figure it out. But what I'm saying is the information is being dispersed. It's being shown. So I'm okay with that. I think that's an awesome step. I think for a civilian organization to display just statistical information for the public is the most important thing. And we're doing that.
Oh, okay. I interviewed James Cameron, right?
Uh-huh.
About 4 years ago. And the impression he gave me at the time of what MUFON was an organization that, one, was, you know, doing the things that you said, like gathering the data, but also doing, you know, under the umbrella of MUFON, doing very radical things. Like, he told me there was a group in Oregon that was trying to do studies with stuff like dimethyltryptamine, where, you know, people report things that sound like abductions or some kind of interaction with something that's not human, at least, you know, mentally when they're on that drug, which I thought, to me, that's very interesting and not really very publicly popular, because
no.
You know, there's horrible, you know, associations people have with those things.
Uh-huh.
But it interested me that MUFON would even be considering, much less supporting, somebody doing that. Do you know if any of that stuff's going on right now or you know, with MUFON's blessing? I would guess not, but maybe you can surprise me.
I have never heard. I've been back in it for 3 years. I have never, ever heard anything like that. Nothing. Nothing. And I am actually the person every day I have to go through everything that comes into CMS and pick out stories that sound very interesting, forward them to the state director, ask them if they can be written about, you know, ask them updates on the case. And I am very intertwined with reviewing every single thing that comes in, everything. And I've never heard of anything like that, anything.
Okay.
I mean, we have close encounter, you know, paperwork. And like I said, we have an experience, the ERT, you know, the experienced research team. And they will, you know, they specialize in the very close encounters and, you know, or the possible, you know, claimed close encounters, and they will take it from there. I have never heard of that happening. Never. At least in the 3 years that I've belonged. And I would be very surprised if I ever heard that. And I think that it would be completely kiboshed immediately.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I actually saw it as something that was actually showed some promise because of the research of Richard Strassman and how he basically stumbled on it, but in a, you know, government-supported research project, people started saying these things to him, and he said, what? This has nothing to do with anything I'm looking for. Why do they keep reporting being, you know, basically examined and talking to these non-human things? That to me, that's a very important piece of the puzzle that if MUFON or somebody could get involved with it, it'd be great. But other than that, I guess it has to be done by independent researchers.
Well, if there was a MUFON researcher who was part of it, then maybe that would be different. I've never heard of it. I know we do like hypnosis therapy and things like that. But I don't think any kind of drug or anything like that is introduced.
Right. No, well, they weren't hypnotizing the people. They were just basically injecting them with the drug in a clinical setting with a nurse and I think somebody else there talking to them while it was going on, making sure everything was okay. This was at the University of New Mexico in the early 1990s, I believe. And yeah. The fact that that kind of stuff was happening was very interesting to me at the time. I think it holds some promise because it looks at the instrument that is receiving these, you know, receiving these impressions, messages, and whatever, and what might be going on. Not something going wrong with it, but what might be going on with the perceptual part of our minds.
You know, I don't know. You should, I don't know. You should interview Kathleen Martin.
I did not know she was into that stuff.
I don't know if she is or not. I know that she is exceptional in extreme close encounters.
Okay. Yeah, I've interviewed some of those people. I had Peter Robbins on my show once, and I said, look, Peter, I have problems with hypnosis being used, and I have problems with the entire abduction scenario and the way that it's basically solidified into what it is. And what we came to, you know, at the end of the show was, I haven't been through what he's been through. I don't know how my opinion would change if I had. If I'd worked with Bud Hopkins for, you know, 20 years or whatever, my opinion might be different. I don't know if it'd be right or wrong or whatever. But there's there's kind of a disconnect there, I guess, between somebody that's gone through something and somebody that's just basically looking at it from the outside, which is what I was. So, you know, I can't discount everything, but I don't have any problem with criticizing methodology just to see how people react to it and what kind of answers they will give me. So we kind of came to an impasse there. But I don't, you know, I'm still kind of worried about hypnosis and how suggestible people are during it. I don't know. As you talk about MUFON with me, I'm starting to think that maybe it's not really it's kind of a top-down organization, but it sounds like it's like the government. People say the government is this. No, it's not. The government is composed of hundreds of thousands of people, all with different agendas.
Yes.
And I think that's, you know, there's a public face of MUFON, which, you know, we talked about a little bit here, but there's also people that are all doing their own thing under the umbrella of MUFON, and which I think is... If that's what's going on, that's a great model. Because that was my model. It's like, well, get rid of the big organizations and just have a whole bunch of people doing their own thing and see what fruit, you know, comes out. Because if everybody's doing the same thing,
yes.
I think that does the phenomenon a disservice because the phenomenon is in no way standardized, I don't think.
Oh, my God. I don't think you can standardize it, no matter what.
Yeah. And so do you think, am I right in saying that MUFON is more like a conglomeration of a bunch of people who are pursuing their own agendas and for the most part being accepted as that? Or are things that don't make any, that aren't popular, are those sort of discouraged?
I think that, how do I answer this?
Yeah, I know. It's that's a weird one. Sorry.
It's okay, because, no, it's a really good question, because when people see MUFON, they think of one thing, you know, like you said. And the thing is inside of MUFON, there are different specialized research teams that, you know, have people with different backgrounds and have people that are educated in different ways, and their strengths are used for that purpose. So if, like I said, the experience of research team, I don't have anything to do with that. When something happens that they need to handle, they handle it. And, you know, I am the paperwork nerd of MUFON. So what exactly they do, I can't tell you. Because they are, you know, yes, they are MUFON. Yes, they are part of the organization. They are following, you know, MUFON's whole way. But there are different people in this that are specialized in their own areas, and MUFON embraces that. It doesn't say, oh, no, you can't do that. But they don't, you know, they don't want anything hysterical going on. But they have people that are specialized in amazing different things that do amazing, you know, things. And doctors, astrophysicists, all these people are, you know, all different people. So I think that MUFON uses that to his advantage to pursue farther.
All right. So if somebody, if I came in with a, like a, if I came in with a theory that 90 or over 90% of many UFO encounters are not created in the witness's mind, but are processed by the witness's mind, so we're not getting a clear picture. Would that be an unpopular thing that I wouldn't be allowed to pursue?
No, that would be, you know, you're going to, there's a lot of different people that are highly skeptical of any kind of information coming in, and they're FIs. And, you know, if they have, the best thing is if they have a photo or a video or something, and if they have a perceptive, okay, I saw a UFO. Well, yeah. Okay, that's unidentified. You know, and we can, you know, go about it better and try to figure it out. But yeah. As for, you know, people think, you know, of those 75,000 cases, there's a lot of them that are hoaxes. There's a lot of them that are IFOs. There's a lot of them that are natural or man-made phenomenon that they just didn't understand. So, you know, having all these cases.
I'm not suggesting that people didn't see something. They're making things up.
Right.
Although that
right.
happens. Of course, that happens a lot.
Oh,
what
yeah.
I'm suggesting is looking at the causes behind and the motivations of how somebody remembers a strange experience and what goes on in their mind at that time and how much of that you can divorce from the initial, you know, unknown that caused that. I think that's the most important part of what should be answered right now myself. And if I came to MUFON with that and say, look, I'm going to look at psychology. I'm going to look at folklore. I'm going to look at, you know, how things affect people and how many layers of something that isn't the experience are added on after the experience happens. That's not a, this is full of crap and people aren't really seeing these things thing. It's more like what's causing it and why are we all discussing it? Because that's the root cause of why we're all here. That's something that I wanted to propose. If I would propose that to MUFON, it's like, look, I would like to, under the aegis of MUFON, propose this sort of study and follow it through to whatever conclusion I come to. Is that something that the organization would be, as an example, is that something the organization would either, you know, would they support it or would they say, well, no, that's not part of our mission statement?
Well, absolutely, because it has to be. It has to be part of it because, you know, if there's a folklore of a certain object in a certain area and people say, well, you know, it's been going on for years. You know, Tammy Joe down the road has been talking about it. You know, all of that stuff is all part of it. Everything. A human, you know, a person's religion or way of life, that's all part of it. Everything. You know, it's like if you and I are sitting in a room with eight other people and there is a red balloon in the beginning, you know, in the middle of the room and it's spinning around and you ask all different eight people what exactly they saw, what color was it, how did it move, what was your take on it, you're going to have eight different answers. And those are important because, you know, you're going to look at the balloon one way, Greg, and I'm going to look at it the other.
Right.
And so that's all important of how it's being seen. Absolutely. I think that a lot of it's done now. I did a research study. We just have a guy that's been real interested in joining MUFON. He has a PhD in folkloric studies. How awesome is that, by the way? But, you know, and I'm like, oh, this is so exciting because, you know, you can start to take these, you know, folkloric things. MUFON is a scientific-based organization. But history is, you know, history is data. And all these things are statistical, in my opinion. That's my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, historical events or things like that, that is data. It's not saying, okay, well, we have the legend of this. No, but it still forms a statistical outlook on cases in a certain area or a certain religion or a certain way of life in a certain area.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, that is all statistical as well. So I think that would be a very good thing to do.
Okay, well, I'll send my paper proposal. I've got one ready.
Do it, because it's an interesting aspect that a lot of people, it's taking it that one step further, Greg.
Yeah, well, that's what I think is happening. Chris Albeck was on Coast to Coast the other day, and I actually was working that night, so I listened. And what he said was, which actually surprised and excited me, was he said, I think there's people that are doing things differently, trying to do things differently, going back to basics and trying not to have assumptions at this point. And that is interesting and exciting. And I agree with him.
Absolutely.
So, like I said, it's going to take a lot for me to get the idea out of my head that MUFON's trying to prove that extraterrestrials are visiting the Earth. but if parts of the organization can work on thinking about it in a different way and trying to pull back from, I guess, the image and the history of the organization and also the ideas that we're all laboring under because of the culture that we live in and everything we've seen and everything we've read and all that, and trying to get away from those influences, that's the exciting part to me, and that something may come out of that. And I see a lot more people doing that now, hopefully within MUFON too, and that might go a little bit towards maybe figuring out what's going on, not proving anything, but trying to figure out what we're dealing with inside ourselves as well as outside.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, if you think about it, with being a large civilian-based organization, you know, there are certain FIs that have strengths that others don't. And they are educated in psychology. They're educated in, you know, and their reports are going to show this. Like, how do I explain this? You know, we're all different civilians. We all do different lives, all do different things. And, but they're, you know, depending on their background is how they're going to excel in, you know, the research that they're doing. Mm-hmm. So it's the same thing. It's just depends on, you know, who the FI is and how they are evaluating the information, and it goes from there.
Red Pill sent me a question he wanted to ask. Does Cassidy think ufology should pursue recognition by the mainstream, or does that ultimately negate its ultimate function as an outside shaper of our culture? Does that make sense?
It does.
Do UFO researchers want people to approve of what they're doing and to prove something to them, or should it pursue its own ends without caring what anybody thinks?
Well, you know what? This brings me back to a kind of comical story back in my hometown area here. And it was the fact that I turned the news on one day and somebody was putting up, and this is a very high-end area where this was happening. It's probably about an hour from where I live. Somebody was putting up like cow abduction beam yellow road signs all over town. I kid you not, Greg. I kid you not.
Oh, no, it's a picture of a cow, and then people like print, like draw on like a UFO with a beam coming out of it.
I think the original sign came from a South Park episode. And they purchasable. So you see a beam and an UFO, and then you see a cow.
Yeah.
You know, a disc-shaped object. So somebody was putting these up all over town, and the news got a hold of it. And they never did find out who did it. But instead of covering the fact that some clown was putting something up from a South Park episode, they took it too far and put it up with the X-Files music in the background, made a big joke about it, started asking, you know, area farmers if their cattle was disappearing, and it was all a very humorous thing. And, you know, my only response to that was, if you ever, and I mean ever, came in contact with any kind of animal mutilation, you would have nightmares for years. And these people, they put these things out with the X-Files music, you know, beam me up, Scotty, at the end. They think it's really funny. Now, if some poor farmer walked out and viewed that in that area, they would be terrified, terrified, because, you know, this is not a comical thing. Yes, the signs were comical, but they had to take it that extra step and say, ooh, is it a cow? And that really aggravates me. And I find that it depends on the media, because there are people who are understanding that these people are researching things and these people are intelligent individuals who have an interest in the subject, that have an interest in, you know, finding questions to unknown things, and they can respect that. But most of the time, it's made a comedy, and So as for getting, you know, here's an example. For years, I was always, hey, Cassidy, is there a ghost in here? Where's your tinfoil hat? Huh, huh, huh. And they thought it was so funny until they see something and they come to me and go, oh, my God, I saw this thing. I don't know what it is. And then they're scared. So it's automatically, you know, the stigma of the media is going to be there forever. And I think that I don't really care, because if anybody got to know these researchers, these people are powerful powerhouses. These people are researching. They're taking time and in funds and everything to expand on this. So, you know, I don't know if we're ever going to get acceptance, you know, of, you know, by the media, because it all depends. But I got interviewed, I'd say like summertime by an investigative reporter in my area. And I got to tell you, Greg, when he first started contacting me, and this man is known for being an investigative reporter, and I said, well, I'm going to tell you something. I said, if you play X-Files music in the background and beam me up at the end, this is a no-go. And he says, no, I am an investigative reporter, and there's a lot of things being seen over our area, and I really want to find out what's going on. And he interviewed me, my God, Greg, you know, he showed me as a professional what I'm doing. He showed me as a researcher, and, you know, that's wonderful. But that was a specialty. So I don't know how the media is ever going to accept it, because it's such a comical thing for people until it either happens to them,
yeah,
or they see something, or they read something that interests them. But until that point, the basis of the social structure in our, it's just going to be, you know, it's going to be a joke until it happens to them. And, yeah. And I'm okay with that. I'm okay with them asking me, where's my tinfoil hat? Because you know what? Get in a conversation with me about statistics. Get in a conversation with me about how many cases we have in our database, or how much these field investigators travel across the country, across the world to pursue this. And tell me that you're doing something better with your time when you're watching TV.
So, well, okay, so basically your answer is that ufology should not particularly care how popular or understandable it is to the mainstream, which I completely agree with, especially the not care part. Because if you don't care about your image, I think that frees you up to do so many other things.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think this is important. I think that there's a lot of numbers there, Greg. There's a lot of numbers, and they've been there forever. I mean, these things are not new. These things are whatever. Whatever's going on is not new. Yeah. And
you don't have to convince me of that.
And I'm okay with that. Like, it's okay with me that I'm seen as, you know, my neighbors are like, oh, what do you do? You know? Yeah. And it's okay, though. I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
Because I'm expanding on my research. I want to know what's going on. I'm not going to come home every day and sit in front of a television. I don't even have a television.
Yeah.
You know, I have, like, I don't have any cable. I don't have anything. But, you know, I want my mind to work. I want to question things. And I think it's sad that people don't. I think it's sad that people say, well, there's nothing going on. This universe is huge. Are you kidding me? You know? So it's like, well, it's okay with me. It's okay. I don't care about my image when it comes to that stuff. I care about my research. I care about doing it the right way, learning from individuals around me. I've learned from this conversation. You know, you learn from everybody you talk to. I'm okay with that.
Well, what do you think is going, you know, what do you think is the source of what MUFON is studying? What do you think is the source of, if it's a true unidentified, do you think there is a source? Do you think there are a variety of them? What's your idea about what you're looking for ultimately?
In my opinion, I don't know. I don't know. Like, I see so many different aspects of things, that there's so many avenues that, you know, I'm doing it the best way that I can. I am, you know, making sure that I don't go out on a loop. But as for what I think is there, I have no idea. I have no idea. And every new case I take, or every new thing that I read, you know, it's interesting to me because I can learn from it and build my opinion on it. But I don't even have one. And I don't think anybody can say with certainty, this is what's going on. You don't know what's going on. None of us know what's going on. All we can do is study what is being viewed and go from there. I have no idea, Greg. I just know that there are things that are happening. Numbers don't lie. You know, there are so many different things going on, and there are so many aspects of those things that are going on. It's just, yeah, everybody's like, what do you think? I don't know. I'm just going to continue to absorb, I guess.
How much of that opinion do you think is shared by the hierarchy of MUFON?
Oh, I've never met anybody in MUFON that says, this is exactly what is happening. Never in my life. And I've talked to a lot of people within the organization on a daily basis, for many different, a multitude of things I talk to, if I need something from one thing or I need work on a case. So I have been lucky enough to get to know a lot of people within the organization, more so than most. And I love it because you learn from people, you know, you learn everything about it. But I've never had somebody say, these little green men are exactly what's going on. No, nobody really, I've never met anybody that has a complete and prompt answer of what these unknown whatever are. Never.
That's totally surprising to me, because my idea is that some or most of the people in MUFON are trying to prove that there's extraterrestrials coming here.
Well,
if that's wrong, I'm very happy.
Well, you know, to be in an organization that is, you know, the scientific study of UFOs for the, you know, for humanity, they're of course already interested in it. They're of course already have their own ideas about it. But I find with the caliber of the different people that I have been able to work with the Scientific Review Board, they are phenomenal people. They are phenomenal, Greg. They really pick apart cases. They're not trying to prove anything. They're trying to pick cases by witness credibility about the work of the FI, things like that. They're never saying, this is what this was. They're saying, we don't know. You know, and so I've never talked to anybody that's going to give a lecture and say, this is exactly what this is. Never. Everybody has, and I feel that with the people that I've been lucky enough to work with, you know, firsthand, I can't speak for everybody in the organization, but I can speak for quite a few. The more you learn, the less you know. And, hopefully. You know, yeah. And a lot of people are, you know, it's an ever-ending thing. I said this recently. I said, anybody who can consider themselves an expert in the field of ufology needs to quit.
Yeah, because nobody's an expert.
Exactly. And if you think you know everything, then it's time to quit, because you're no longer expanding your research. You're no longer looking at everything. You're just saying, okay, well, I think this is this. And, you know, you just quit after that.
Yeah.
And just quit at that point, because you're not an expert. I am like, if I look at the dirt under my fingernail, I don't even know that much about what's going on. You know what I'm saying? My opinion changes all the time. I have a hard time writing down anymore. I used to do it when I was younger, especially with the paranormal. I would give my opinion on things, and I was very stout about it. You know, oh, this is my opinion. I have found, you know, in the last few years, to stop writing down opinions, because they'll change quickly. And they'll, you know, the more you start to learn and have access to things, that opinion is going to change. So I've just learned to stop writing down opinions, because it's never going to be the same the more that I learn.
Mm-hmm.
So the people that I've worked with, you know, Richard Hoffman, Morgan Bell, you know, Robert Powell, these people feel the same way. They're amazing. Jan Harzan, our executive director, Roger Marsh. It's just a constant learning environment for them. What they're trying to do as part of the organization is to learn how to take this information in the best way possible to continue to learn from it.
I know that you have been interested in lots of other aspects of the paranormal besides UFOs for mm-hmm. quite a while. Can you draw any parallels between UFOs and other Freudian mysteries like cryptozoology and ghosts and things like that?
Well, I can speak from my own opinion.
Yes, your opinion.
My own opinion is, it depends on the case, but I call them playgrounds. That's kind of like my joke for it. Mm-hmm. Is if you get a
location, I know what you mean immediately.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah. Like, if you get a location where they're like, we're seeing lights in the sky all the time, and then I saw this green mist go through this field, and then, you know, we saw, you know, and these guys, and it's the best part of it is that you're talking to people who you know, aren't into the shows and aren't into the showmanship of it and aren't into trying to prove themselves to be anything. These people are very normal people. And they'll say, you know, what's really weird is, you know, we have all this paranormal activity. It could be the pipes. It could be anything. But they're having, you know, a ghostly activity of some sort. And then all of a sudden they're seeing UFOs or anytime, something that's unidentified, you know, and they're seeing something walking through the woods and they're hearing bangs at night. So I call them playground cases. And I find them extremely interesting. I have come in contact with quite a few of them. There are some people that say, absolutely not. There's one has nothing to do with the other. Myself, what I do if I get something like that, where they're having so many things going on at once, in my own research, I start to go backwards. And I start to say, okay, then what is it about this place that is creating all this attention, whatever it may be? It could be nothing, you know? But I want to find out why. And normally, you can start to dig up something, you know, in history and things like that that have gone on that might make it more attractive of an area of, you know, I won't get into basic or, you know, the details of things, but you can find things that are pretty amazing. But yes, I've seen that happen, and that's what I call them. I'm like, oh, this is a playground, you know, and that might be anything from a witness going, oh my God, I see this, and I see this, and I see this, and I see this. Or it could actually be legitimately that something is happening.
How do you mean that it's legitimately something that's happening between a witness seeing things? What's the difference between those two?
Well, in the past, when I have things called playgrounds, and this was even before MUFON, where there, you know, I would spend days. We would camp at these places and try to evaluate all these different things. You might stay out there for 3 days and see nothing. You know?
Yeah.
But, you know,
that's usually what happens.
Oh, yeah. But sometimes, you know, you have to kind of try to distinguish if somebody is seeing all these things. Oh, yeah. All these things. I played with a Ouija board. Now I have 6 ghosts, you know, 14 chickens, 2 Bigfoots, and 7 UFOs. You know.
Yeah. I see what you mean.
Yeah. So, you know, after you kind of get a feel for what's going on, get a feel for the property, start to rip that property apart, try to, you know, see what may be causing this, and then go from there. But yeah, I've seen a lot of times where people say, well, the activity here in the house started going crazy, and then like 3 days later, we're seeing this, and we don't understand what's happening. So I guess, like, that's another thing that I don't know, but I want to learn more about. I want to be, you know, it's one of those, I want to know everything kind of things, because it's like, why is this happening? But yes, I see a correlation in it in my work, personal level-wise.
Okay, well, then the next obvious question to me and everybody, it's like, people want stories. I always get criticized because I don't ask for stories. What is the strangest, weirdest, or most involved, whatever, just something that kind of, you know, what's your A case of that kind of activity?
Well, I won't get into details, but I will say that there was a case that I was involved with for a few years, actually, and they had everything from the Bigfoot sightings. I have mixed feelings on the Bigfoots and the, you know, any kind of cryptozoology. I have mixed feelings on, which I shouldn't, but, and like I said, like green or red mists floating through the area and, you know, UFO, activity at the same time, which is something unidentified. I'm not saying, you know, extraterrestrial.
Yeah.
And they were having, plus they were having things happen in their house. And this was amazing to me. I thought, goodness gracious, you know, and so we were doing all the different, you know, the different things, and it was a collective of a lot of amazing people at that point, because what was really cool is this was a very large tract of land, and I got to meet, you know, there was the Bigfoot people that showed up, and then there was, you know, the ufologists that showed up, and the paranormal investigators, and what was kind of cool is that everybody was working with each other.
Really? You know, I was about to say, did they hate each other, or... Yeah.
No, in this aspect, like, this was, you know...
How long ago was this?
Probably right around 2009, 2010.
Oh, so fairly recently.
Yeah. And, you know, all the people were working together. All of them became instant friends. And to me, that's always been the most memorable case because they had so much going on. So, you know, historically speaking, They ended up being on the site of an archaeological dig in the 70s. That was a very odd dig, a very interesting Native American origin. And it was amazing to me how so much attention was going on, so much activity. And yet, if you stem back, you know, here's an archaeological dig, you stem back further and further. So to me, I was not present for any kind of Bigfoot sightings. I was not there at the time. That was after my time. But at the time, I had worked with different people from the state that were very heavily involved with Bigfoot activity. And they were, you know, they gave me a tree knocker. And I very proudly hang it in my office. You know, this is a tree knocker. With it, you know, this is how you call it. You know, it was a
what the hell is that? Is that like a Bigfoot signaling device? I've never heard of such a thing.
I know. It's sitting right here in my office next to me. And what it is, it's about a foot and a half of wood. It's got a leather strap, and they're varnished, and it looks really cool. And they bang the trees. And it was a learning experience for me because I had never been involved in any kind of Bigfoot hunts or anything like that. I never was involved in it, never. And
but what is it used for? Is it like a
signal? They bang it on the trees.
What?
They bang it against a tree. The bang, yeah. Bang, bang.
Who does?
The Bigfoot investigators.
Okay. what to what end?
They bang them, and I guess they wait for responses.
Oh,
like I
see.
Said, I am in no way anything with Bigfoots or cryptozoology.
You know what it sounds like? It's long distance psychic phenomena. Meaning, instead of sitting in a room and having somebody knock on the walls or having a Ouija board, you're doing the same thing. You can't see what's causing the thing, but you're communicating with something.
Like I said,
yeah.
You know, but I've never been involved in that.
I've never heard of that.
Oh, yeah. I learned all sorts of stuff. And it was like everybody worked together. And we had everything from green mist moving through an area to any kind of abnormal, you know, issues in the house. And to me, it was the first playground that I had ever come in contact with. And it gave me the ability to start to see things a little differently when I came across site work that had more than one thing, had four swings instead of one, you know, had a slide too.
Yeah.
And I think that was a mountaintop, yeah. And it was in a very rural area, and the family owned the entire mountaintop. So I have all these things happening. And this is also, I forgot to mention, a lot of time loss in certain parts of this land, you know, and these were experienced by even people that were Amish that were working there.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it was a very interesting case. It was one of the more interesting cases I've ever worked. They had everything from the, you know, actual tracks in the snow that were 10 feet apart. I'm like, I don't know how that could be faked. You know what I'm saying? They were losing chickens. They were, you know, it was amazing to me. It was just one of those crazy things that I'll always remember. And I took a lot of, you know, I have a lot of research on it. And since then, you know, I've left the case and moved on to other things, but that to me is probably my most memorable because I learned a lot during that time,
mm-hmm.
about the ability to see things as a whole instead of focusing on one thing. Like when I went in there at that time, I was only focused on the paranormal activity. I didn't care about anything else. That case taught me to look at everything. So that's what I credit that case with.
So what happened to that family? I mean, is it still going on, or what happened? You know, what's the follow up on it?
Well,
what's that? About seven years ago now, almost.
I don't know. They live about 5 hours away, and I haven't kept in contact in the last couple of years. Emails here and there. How you doing? You know, but after, you know, the group that I was with spent a lot of time there. Another different group had moved in, and they began to do their research with their equipment and stuff, and I kind of backed off of it. So hopefully they're doing well. I'm sure they are. They're an amazing family, wonderful people.
Mm-hmm.
And so after that, I kind of backed off because there was, at the time, there was people with higher tech equipment and more enthusiasm, I guess.
Did things change as a result of, did the family say that anything changed as a result of investigators showing up?
Not that I recall, but that specific case had a lot of activity going on, like a lot of it, to the point where it was a constant thing. So when investigators were there or not, it, you know, I don't think it made a big difference, I think. But they also were very keen on cataloging when something happened.
And, who was?
You know, the family themselves.
Oh, okay.
They, throughout the years, they got very good in cataloging different sightings and different things, writing things down, dates and times. And there was
that
even,
would be really interesting to look at.
Yes. And even there was, you know, when all the time was missing, I even went down there and I left. I had two exact stopwatches, and I left one down, you know, at the bottom. And then I brought one to the house, and I spent the whole day there just to compare, you know. Of course, that day, nothing came out of it. But it was like that kind of research that opens you up to, okay, why is this happening? So they were very, very good on, you know, keeping the research. Like I said, they moved on to people with better equipment and whatnot. But this was a few years ago. So I think they're doing quite well.
Okay. Yeah, because sometimes when people have that going on, I think the main reason is, can you make this stop? What, you know, one, what, no, one, let us share this with you. Two, can you explain to us what's going on? And three, can you make it stop? Because it's really, it's really screwing with our lives. Is that what was going on there? It sounds like they were more kind of like engaged with it.
They were very interested in it. You know, at no time did they say, I want this all to stop, actually. Which I think also sets them apart from a lot of different things that I've been part of.
Yeah.
Because most of the time, they want it to stop. And, you know, you have these people that can go in, especially in the paranormal field. Yes, we will take care of this. We will clean this house. You know, it's like a 1970s
Which I think is a really silly thing to be claiming in the first place.
Right. And it's like a 1970s bad horror flick, really. It's like, okay, here, let me come in my cape and my Bible and we'll take care of it. And the thing is what I've found is in aspects of when a family is experiencing something, do your best, either whether it be, you know, possible extraterrestrial or paranormal of any kind, specter, whatever. The most important thing is to figure out what's happening, figure out why it's happening. And that can be down to people having dreams that they're being abducted and realizing that they're sleeping in a couch that has their head between two 1920s era light sockets, you know, and showing them the measurements of what is actually going on and saying, move your couch, the dreams will stop, you know. But I think that the most important thing is you're not going to be able to wipe something clean. You don't even know what it is. Good luck with that. Good luck, you know. And I think that the best thing that you can do is psychologically talk to these people the best that you can and say, you know, this might be what's happening, this might not be what's happening, and basically give them the ability to either understand it, fix it, or whatever. But you're not going to walk in and say, this house is clean. No way. It's learning to deal with it.
Yeah, I had the same friend that was talking to me about how people's brains encode experience and how it comes back out. He said that he actually sat with this friend of his that was schizophrenic. I'm not calling these people schizophrenic. But he sat with a friend of his that was schizophrenic, and he let the guy tell him everything that was going on with him without stopping him, without telling him he was wrong or telling him he was crazy. And he said that got rid of most of it.
Yeah.
Just talking the stuff out.
Oh, absolutely.
And that might be a key of what's going on with, you know, that might actually make the diminish the stuff, but actually having people share what's going on, how they feel about it, and whatever, and unloading that on somebody else that's not judging them. I think that actually cleans it up more than anything else. Do you think that's true?
I absolutely think that's true. I think fear is a very big thing, Greg. And I think that fear can cause a multitude of things to happen. And
yeah, it might make you think people are listening to your phone conversations and opening your mail.
Right.
You know, I was going to mention that. When I stopped worrying about it, it pretty much stopped.
Yeah. Because, well, think about it. If you hear something, if you're walking through a dark room and and something drops, you're automatically turned up. You're like, oh, my God, what's that noise? And then all of a sudden, every single thing that happens for the next, like, hour, you're like, oh, my God, it's there again. You know, but if it was a normal thing that you were sitting there reading a book and you were, you know, having some tea and just going about your business, you're going to hear something and go, eh, and keep going. But if that fear is like turned up,
yeah.
these you're going to be more, you're going to be listening to everything. You're going to be, you know, if there's a bent corner, like you said with the mail, there's a bent corner in the mail. Somebody was looking at this or, you know, my book is out of place. Something moved. And it's like, you have to learn how to digest everything. And most of the time, it's not what you think it is. It's your heater kicking on. It's the boiler working. It's the, you know, a fox outside. That's why your dog's barking. There's not any tea out there. There's a fox in your yard, you know?
Yeah. No, it's a fox. It's an ET that looks like a fox.
Right.
Well, you know, see, I get this image in my mind after you say that, if somebody's sitting there reading a book and like a wine glass goes flying across the room and smashes on the wall, and they just look up and say, "Cut it out, I'm reading."
There are some cases where, you know, they have any kind of poltergeist, whatever is going on, whatever it may be, if anything. And they kind of learn to deal with it. Like, to give you another story, a woman had contacted me years ago. This is probably 2006. And said, "I have a demon in my house." I said, "Okay, you probably don't, but whatever." And what it was is she was explaining these smells she was getting and these bangs on the floor and what was happening. She was terrified.
Smells. That's good. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Lots. I'm smelling urine. I'm smelling the smell, you know, of things, and it's scaring me. And she was going to move out of her house. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's evil. It's evil. And from what different research I could find, and I spent a lot of time with that individual, and I found, historically speaking, again, I'm a big history buff. I think that history is the most important aspect of research. And, you know, don't come to conclusions, look back. And I found, you know, the man that lived in this house before had very bad emphysema and was actually bedridden in that room. And, you know, one of the main things the man would do is if he had to pee, he'd bang on the floor with his cane.
Mm-hmm.
So if it was paranormal, if it wasn't, it was still the aspect of saying, okay, this is my idea and my opinion of what is happening. After I discussed with her what I had found out historically and what, you know, may have been happening, whatever, you know, whatever beliefs anybody has, it was completely to the point where, oh, it's not an evil thing that's going to kill me. It's just, you know, something, an imprint or whatever is happening. Oh, well, now I understand. She lived there for many years after that.
Did the stuff stop?
It slowed way down, and when it did happen, there was more of a general understanding of what it possibly could be, and that fear was gone, and the family resided there fine.
Yeah, well, it seemed like the fear, whatever the thing is that's going on, either one, fuels it, or two, more importantly, is your impression of it, so you, like you said, become hypersensitive no matter what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So, mm-hmm. Yeah, just being able to talk it out and, like you said, get an explanation of what's going on. I think it's a reflexive thing where, one, it, you know, it makes you less paranoid about it, so you probably, you know, just filter out a lot of it. And two, maybe on a different level, or a, if you want to call it a paranormal psychic level, it diminishes it too, because the fear was fueling it.
Yeah, whatever it may be, you know, it trying to figure out. You know, the best thing about that, and what I did enjoy about that field when I heavily researched it, was patterns and times and the dates and, you know, dealing with people and saying, if something happens, you need to write this down. Keep a journal. I'd always bring a notebook, you know, a spiral notebook and a pen, and say, keep this with you.
Mm-hmm.
Put it in your purse. Because if you hear something, I want you to write the exact date and time. And, you know, after, I'd say, if a couple months of this, you can start to see literal patterns. Every morning at 8 o'clock, the cabinets open in the kitchen.
Yeah.
You know, and things like that. And I think that that's really important. And it's a lot of thing that bothers me is a lot of researchers in that field have no credibility because they don't take the time. You know, it takes time to see patterns. It takes time to see how things affect, you know, families that live there. It takes time to see what is happening, if anything. You know, so.
It sounds like a lot of, go ahead.
Keep going.
It sounds like some of the investigators are in there just basically for, you know, to get a thrill and not really pay attention to what's going on and solve the thing. They're just kind of addicted to the thrill of whatever might be going on and experiencing that, and not really caring what's causing it, how it's affecting the people, and how that interaction may be part of what's going on. Am I correct in that?
Yeah, you are. And the thing is, I think that's what forced me to untimely leave that area of research, because I still, once in a while, if something happens or whatever, I'll get a phone call. But it's, you know, when somebody takes something, okay, we have a haunted location. We're going to go in tonight and do an EVP session. We're going to be there for 3 hours. That's not research. That is a preliminary. You have to really work something. If you're going to work it, you have to work it properly. You have to, you know, take time. And a lot of times, you know, I'll hear these EVPs come up that are, and I'll say, I don't hear anything other than crap. And it's like, you know, and then sometimes they'll say, this is saying, get out or I'll kill you. And if you listen to it, and if it is, you know, something there that's an anomaly you know, sometimes it's speaking in different languages, you know, things like that. And they're like, this is undistinguishable. I said, well, then you don't speak French. You know what I'm saying? So it just takes time to
learn.
Well,
the other thing is they tell you, this is what it says here. What the hell do you think you're going to hear when you hear that?
Right. And if it's not something that you have to, like, listen and listen and listen to over and over again, like, I think I hear something, that's not something, it's something worth looking at. It's not something worth saying, this is our research. You know, sometimes you'll see families affected and the only, you know, you might go there 10 times, nothing happens. So what you can do is you can you can start to document your dialogue, document what's happening, and go from there, you know. So I get frustrated because for me, if I handle something, it's like, okay, you know, and I'm no expert. I'm nothing. I just try to do my best, and it's an interesting aspect, but it's like, I'm not going to handle something one night and say, okay, I'm done. It's going to take me, you know, if I take something on, it's at least a year of work.
Yeah. So you're it's like the UFO thing, your model for this, I would assume, would be, I don't know, right?
I don't know. I've
know whether there's ghosts or malevolent spirits or people's, you know, psychological problems or a psychokinetic, or you have no idea, right? Is that your attitude?
It is. It is that whatever, you know, and I can say this in both ufology and, you know, psychical research, it's above me. Whatever it is, all I can do is learn from it. And my opinions will change constantly with the more that I find out. I'm very young. I have seen some very crazy things in my young life. I think about it sometimes and I'm like, geez, Cass, you know, and I have seen some things that don't make sense to me that I still can't figure out, but I can't in any way form a conclusion on what I know that these things are, because I can't, because without, you know, something being able to be replicated in a lab, or without something, you know, having enough research on it, all I can do is read and educate and go from there. So I can't say, this is definitely what you have going on. No, I will never say that. I'll say, let me try to figure out how we can handle this and go from there.
Mm-hmm. I was reading one of your responses to somebody about your attitudes towards your investigations, and somebody was talking about, I can't remember what their question was, but your answer, it said something like you had gone from an atheism or at least some sort of agnosticism to believing in God or some, you know, universal aspect that people call that. So how did that happen, and what was the change, and what do you think right now as regards to some sort of supreme being?
Well, there I go, writing my opinions down again.
Yes. Well, I thought this might be a good one to end with.
Well, you know, and of course it has changed yet still. I know exactly where you're reading those. I think it was a Mysterious Universe interview that I did. And at that time, I had just finished about a 5-year research case that literally scared the pants off me. It was terrifying. And, you know, experienced things that were so out of the ordinary that I couldn't excuse them. And I was terrified. And of course, when you go into something, at that time when I had began that research, I was invincible. I knew everything. And, you know, I learned very quickly that I don't know anything. And I am not invincible. I am a little being of nothing. And that case frightened me so badly that at that point in my life, I was when I started it, I was invincible. I thought, you know, science only, and you know, but I had also other attributes that weren't interesting to me too. So it was like, I was kind of like a big hot mess, to be honest with you. And I was probably about 20 when I started that case, which anybody at 20 shouldn't start anything.
No, geez, of course
not. But at the time, you know, you were invincible. And that case showed me that I wasn't. And that case was really, if I could go back in time, I don't know. I guess I would redo it again the same way, because it taught me so much about myself. It taught me so much about research, proper research, how to handle things, how to handle situations psychologically, and how to handle like intense situations that have no absolute scientific reasoning to them. There's nothing that you can say that makes any sense.
Well, how about one example of just really what, you know, as an example of what made you start changing your mind, what affected you?
My family suffered greatly through that. You know, I'm a mother, mm-hmm. and I have one small child. And it was interesting things like you wake up at the exact time every night, and all of a sudden you hear a bang and a thump, and your two-year-old is halfway across the room. Huh. And it's not like he fell out of bed. He's all the way across his room. And things like that, it was like, I do not have control of this situation. I don't know what I'm doing. And, or I had a, here's another one. I had a coffee table. You know the coffee tables, they have like the lion's feet, and they have three glass panels in them. They're very nice.
Yeah.
I had one of those literally explode in my living room and shoot glass across the entire room. Nobody hit it. Nothing fell on it. All three panels went. And it was terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
And my living room at the place that I was residing at the time was about 30 feet long. It was a very long living room. It had a big mantle at the end, and it was probably about 15 feet wide. It was a very large room. And I can remember picking glass out of my heaters along the walls and just being astonished with the projection of it. And
yeah,
so
I had something, you know, like that happen with a glass once in my hand.
Yeah. And so it was these things that started happening. The night I started having nightmares, I was very fearful. My husband started having nightmares. There were things that happened. One night in bed, I woke up in the middle of the night, and I sat straight up, and it was one of those panics that you just wake right up. And the bed started jumping off the ground. And this sounds like, again, we'll go into, it sounds like a 1970s bad horror flick. But these things were happening, and it taught me that I was not invincible. I don't know what happened. I cannot justify to this day a reasoning for these things that were happening. But what I can say is I am in no way a God-toting individual. But I know, you know, my husband once said to me, and I think it really holds true, Greg, he says, how can you believe that there's a down, but there's not an up? He says, you know, you have these feelings and you know these dark things exist, whatever they are. I'm not saying they're anything.
Right.
I'm saying, I call it in my research, the negative and positive polarity of things.
Yeah.
There's always a negative and a positive, and that's how I go for it. And so with my interactions with the negative polarity, I know that there has to be a positive polarity.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I call them. Everybody's like, oh, you know, jinn, demons, all this crazy stuff. And I say, I don't say any of that. I say there's a negative polarity and a positive polarity. And that, just like two magnets, they have to interact with each other. And
yeah,
I might sound like
you don't have one without the other, obviously, yes.
Right. And I might sound like a loony bin, but that's my research on it. You know, I've seen a lot of things. I've had a lot of things happen. And at that point in my life, I was kind of bewildered. And so I started to try to realize if there's a negative, there's a positive. Whatever it is, it could be something completely explainable in 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
In 10 years, we could scientifically prove what is happening, you know?
Yeah.
So I can't say one thing or another, but I can say that at that time, I was quite nervous. And the only thing that helped me at the time was to start to try to focus on that positive polarity. Now, like I said, there I go writing my opinions down. My opinions, I've still changed to whatever that positive polarity is, it's there. And it's been there, you know, mankind since the beginning, as far as we can, you know, historically go back, has always had some kind of positive polarity, whether it be a god, many gods, mm-hmm. whatever. Mm-hmm. They've always focused on that. And that to me is interesting. Whether it's the human, you know, psychological way of saying, okay, this is why this is happening. Our crops aren't growing because this God is mad, or, you know, things like that. I've taken that all into account and I've studied the history of religions. And all I can say is it's, you know, it's a, there's positive and negative. And I'm sitting there in the middle and I'm saying, okay, there's some stuff out there that I have no idea. And I don't know, but I'm going to sit there and I'm going to look into it and I'm going to look at its origins and I'm going to go historically back. And, you know, I'm sitting in my office, Greg, and I'm looking at the bookshelf beside me and I have everything from an introduction to Hinduism to Satan to
yes.
four or five different holy Bibles, you know.
Yeah, sounds like my bookshelf. So, yes.
Yeah. And it's so I've, you know, and the occult, I have a larger collection on the occult, not because I practice it, because I'm interested in how humanity saw this mm-hmm. and how they went about, you know, just, you know, making reasonings behind what, you know, things that happened, storms and crops and things. So to this point, I can say, I don't know what the question was, but I know, you know, that was an interview that I did right after that.
The question was, you know, how did you go from not a belief in some sort of supreme goodness, as you say it, to mm-hmm. some sort of belief in it? And you did, you very, very, very,
yeah.
very thoroughly answered that question.
Sorry. Like I said, I don't write opinions down anymore.
Well, you know, the thing is, if you have opinions, you want to express them. I think they should be written out or should be said. And then, you know, if somebody says, well, you said this, the only thing you say is, I changed my mind.
Yeah.
Is that allowed?
Yeah, right? And you know, and that's a lot of problems that I see, too, with ufology, is a researcher will put out an explanation on something that they believe in their opinion of what it is. And that researcher is forever stuck in that.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, don't talk to them at this point. And the thing is researchers are allowed to change their mind. I've seen a lot of researchers fall victim to this. And once they make an opinion, they're blacklisted. And, you know, I think that this whole field of research needs to be forgiving in the aspect of people's opinions are allowed to change. People are allowed to learn more and change. And I find it's a big problem. Is if one person has an opinion on something, that's them forever.
Yeah, so. they're that guy or that girl or gal or whatever you want to call it. But yeah that which is exactly what paranormal shows and media and stuff do too. It's like this is that person that does this thing, and if you don't say the thing that we're expecting you to say, then you know, then we have no use for you. Which mm-hmm. which is stupid. I was on a show called The Conspiracy Zone for a while as a consultant.
Yeah.
And a couple times they said, oh, look, you know, we can't get this guest or that guest or, you know, whoever I suggested couldn't make it. Could you fill in? It's like, okay. So I'd go to the run-through and the rehearsal, and they'd ask me a question. I'd say, well, you know, there's this thing and then there's this thing, so, you know, you can't really say for sure. And they say, you can't equivocate. That's you can't do that. It's like, well, that's how I feel.
Right.
Sorry. Right.
Absolutely.
So yeah, there's a dichotomy and a polarity to bring that up again that people expect to have, and if you walk into the paranormal or ufology or anything like that, thinking that anything's fixed, you're lost already. It's completely right. You know that you have to be ready to be as mercurial as the subject itself.
Absolutely, and I can say if there's one thing I've learned from the different research and the crazy different subjects that I've looked into is you don't know. You don't know anything. And, you know, like I said, at 20 years old, I was, I knew everything, Greg. I knew it all.
That's how most people are. I feel like when I was 20, I didn't feel like I knew everything. I felt like I didn't know anything, and to like a really bad degree. So I started off with a deficit, I think. And then, you know, I never went through the know anything stage, I don't think.
Thank
I hope
God.
Not. But yeah, most people at you know, 20 and teenager and that, yeah, of course they know everything.
Yeah, and it took just learning that you don't, you know, like I said, that one case we talked about, learning you have no control over what is happening. All you can do is observe it.
Mm-hmm.
Observe it and learn from it. So I'm learning slowly, Greg, you know.
Yeah, well, I think that's the best attitude you can have is, I don't know anything and I'm willing to learn.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if you can keep that attitude and be agnostic about it, at least about, you know, having an opinion, I think that's where some knowledge comes from. And like you said, there's so many walls built up to keep you from doing that, you know, by other people's opinions and pigeonholing and having to have a certain opinion about something and all that. It holds people back and it holds the field back. And that's what I wanted to talk to you about MUFON, because I have certain ideas about what it is. I think you've changed some of those. I hope they're correct.
Good.
But you know, if somebody's in the hierarchy of MUFON that it just says, I don't know, that gives me a little bit of hope.
Yeah, I mean, you know, everybody
well,
that
the other thing is the loudest people are usually the ones that everybody hears.
Yeah, but you know, you have to look at it as a collection and say this is a civilian-based organization, and we are thousands. And if there's one that gives an opinion about something and says, this is MUFON's opinion, that is not fair, because it's not. You know, MUFON is a scientific study of UFOs. And we're not talking, you know, one of the things was UFOs are not extraterrestrial. They are an unknown flying object. They could be a balloon. Yes. It could be anything. And I think a lot of people's misconceptions are, those are the alien people. And the thing is these people have a genuine want to learn and a genuine want to study. And you're going to have varying opinions. So, you know, going off one or two that is always a spokesy, you know, person or on a lot of different radio channels or a lot of different things, you have to take that into effect of they are their own person. They are their own. And there's a multitude of individuals all over the world that have completely different opinions.
Yeah.
So they can't speak for an organization because they are only a small part of it.
Well, who speaks for MUFON? Everybody?
Jan Harzan speaks for MUFON. And he's our executive director. I mean, I can place my opinions with you. You know, we can talk about my opinions on things. But as for the opinions of MUFON, you know, we have our mission statement there. We have, you know, what we're trying to do. And then the people that are in the organization, you know, follow that. But they're also their own people. So I think I get frustrated when one person comes out and says, well, because I'm part of MUFON, everything that I say is important. It's not. You are part of MUFON. That is an aspect of your life. But that doesn't mean that the opinions of MUFON are that singular person's.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
so,
well, I hope
a lot of us.
Yeah, I hope people that listen to the show take that into account. You know, because like I said, usually the loudest people are the ones everybody assumes, like, okay, well, that's what this thing is that loud person saying this thing. And that's often not true for any organization or for any belief system. The loudest person is what everybody listens to.
No, I mean, we have so many, I call them powerhouses within the organization, and they are amazing people. They're wonderful in their field of study, whatever that may be, or their education or their employment. They're really good at what they do.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all part of that connection that makes an organization strong. But the thing is that people have to know that these people are there and, you know, listen to them. They do give lectures and talks, and they go out and they say, okay, this is, you know, how to estimate this, or this is how to do this. And these are pretty cut and dry, you know, even down to training field investigators, you know how to properly use a compass, know what you're doing, know what these things are, know what radiation is. There's the state director of Pennsylvania gives lectures all about, you know, field investigative works. We have a MUFON university that's going to happen where people can learn all the different aspects and be completely educated in going in, not just saying, okay, so it's kind of by that tree over there. All right, that sounds good. No, you know, actually getting our investigators really educated. And like I said, people have strong points and not, but see MUFON as a whole. You know, we have a lot of scientific papers written by Robert Powell on the site that are amazing. We have the archive, that's the digital archive that we're producing, that's amazing. So it's not just one person. It's a lot of different people.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Jan Harzan is the best one to speak on, you know, what our mission statement is and what we try to do. But, you know, we're thousands of different people excelling in different avenues.
Okay. Well, thanks for clearing up stuff about MUFON and letting me be sort of aggressive and occasionally slightly nasty with my questions. I hope it wasn't too terrible.
Absolutely not.
Because I've got certain ideas, and if you've listened to my show, you know what they are, and because I want people to hear what, you know, you have to say, and how to, you know, step back a little bit and say, look, it's not all bad, and perhaps some of it is good. I thank you so much for sharing all that with us. Is there any way that you want people to get in touch with you or read any of the things, any of the books you've written? Because you've written, what, three, I think?
Yes. Those are more of the paranormal. I can tell you, to be really honest with you, I was not as decent of a writer as I am now. Everybody kind of has that aspect. They look back on their stuff. And you know what? If they want to read, you know, what I'm producing now, and I'm a staff writer for Intrepid Magazine. I do pieces there, here and there for them. And I love doing that because they allow me to do anything that I want. It's really fun. Uh-huh. I write for the MUFON Journal, which is an excellent publication. And, so that's basically where, and I'm writing all the archives. I'm writing up these archival stories and producing graphics and things like that on the website so people can kind of get a look at what they're seeing, you know, I take what the witnesses describe and I build a graphic. Mm-hmm. And that is so much fun to me. It's hard, but it's fun.
Yeah.
So a lot of things I'm doing now are basically MUFON oriented, you know, and Intrepid Magazine oriented. So if they want to get in touch with me, I actually use Facebook under Cassidy Nicholas. It is a like page because I have anxiety with social media. I hate it. And so
I understand.
Yeah. So I have a like page, but it is actually me. I constantly, if somebody emails me, I will write them back. I will, you know, anything. Even if it's, I've had emails, I hate you. Okay. Thank you. Have a nice day. You know,
how could you have an I hate you email?
Oh, come on. There's really no gray area with Cassidy. Either you love Cassidy or you hate Cassidy. So I have to understand that people are allowed to have their own opinions. So, I mean, I love discussion. I love conversation. And it is actually me on that like page. So that's okay. Where I do most of my stuff. And my email is cassidy@mufon.com.
Okay, excellent. Mm-hmm. Every time I have somebody on, I've started a tradition in the last few months. I play music at the end of the show. What do you have a piece of music that you want me to play at the end of the show as after our conversation? And I'll put it on there, or you can send it to me and I'll put it on there.
I'll have to think about that and I'll send it to you.
Okay.
There's so many.
I've gotten all over because I used to pick it and it was always something extremely strange. But last time I had, because I have a huge collection of flying saucer music from like the 1940s up to now. Yeah, like probably 80 or 100 different UFO songs.
Well, that might be more interesting if you pick it.
Oh, well, I don't know. Maybe I'll send you a few examples.
But, we'll figure it out.
Yeah.
Where fly, stayed by the ground. I don't desire to stay. Once they cruised around the world, sorry that they found the world they quit.